This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no younger. Your pain and your hunger, they're driving you home. And freedom, oh, freedom, well, that's just some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone. Don't your feet get cold in the wintertime? The sky won't snow and the sun won't shine. It's hard to tell the nighttime from the day. Maybe raining, but there's a rainbow above you. You better let somebody love you.
Let somebody love you.
You better let somebody love you before it's too.
So this is part one show of Speaking with Mark, and next week we're going to do part two. So tune in next week. Don't forget, this is a two-part show. So let's meet our guest. Would our guests like to introduce themselves and give us a quick sketch of who you are?
Yeah, kia ora, Kerry. Hey, everybody. My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. I am 38 years old. My sobriety date is the 4th of September 2012. I'm currently working as a therapist, predominantly working with people who are in the midst of alcohol and drug use.
Wow, so you do it for a job as well?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, I've developed a real passion for sparking little bits of hope, which somebody sparked for me when I first got sober.
That's wonderful. Right. Are you married? Do you have a family?
So I've got a partner. We've been together for several years, and I've got two stepdaughters. One's 17 years old, one's 14 year old.
Wow, nice.
And I have the light of my life, who's my baby son, who is 4.5 months old.
Oh, wow. That's lovely.
Yeah.
So where are you from originally, Mark? Where did you grow up?
I was born in a little town in the middle of the North Island called Tokoroa.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised there until I was about 12, 13. It's a forestry town where my father was working.
Where's that near?
So it's in the South Waikato, so it's between, I'd say, Rotorua and Hamilton.
Okay.
And my father was working there on forestry, and there was just a decline in that. So we ended up moving from there into a city called Dunedin.
Okay.
Which is a little bit of a cultural shock.
But well, that's quite an opposite.
Yes, very much so. And again, so I come from, my father's Māori, yep, and my mother is Scottish in heritage. Mm-hmm. And growing up in Tokoroa was really interesting because being half Māori, half Scottish, is in a predominantly Māori town, is I always felt like I was just, I wasn't Māori enough to fit in with a lot of the kids there, right. So I felt like I didn't really belong there.
Yes.
And then when I was about 12, 13, we moved down to Dunedin, mm-hmm, and then there was almost an opposite shift.
Yes.
I felt like I was too Māori to really fit in within a predominantly European setting.
A bit like Meghan Markle.
Very much so, very much so. Like there was always, from a very early age, there was this belief that I never really belonged anywhere and I never really fitted in. Mm.
So how was your childhood? How was it at home?
So like there was, in the early days, there was, some of my earliest memories are not very pleasant. Mm-hmm. There's got some childhood trauma that came from that.
Yes.
Again, predominantly there was a lot of alcohol use, there was a lot of... In the very early days, there was domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my earliest memories is very unpleasant. So from there was the shift where my father, he made some really dramatic changes with his life. And he
in
flipped it around. Oh, like he absolutely flipped it around. He realized that some of his behaviors were not acceptable and that he was going to lose his kids as a result of that. Oh, so he made some really positive changes. And addressed his alcohol and addressed the violence. And yeah, like, I mean, I guess if anything, we come from a long line of substance use, a long line of normalized violence, a long line of gangs.
So he broke the chain.
He started a process.
He stopped it from being passed down generational.
Yeah, I think he certainly started a process. Like,
yes.
I'm unsure if I'd really consider him to be an alcoholic because mm-hmm. he was able to manage that.
Mm-hmm.
My experience when I try to manage it, something different happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when did you start drinking and how did it progress?
Okay, like it. So again, moving to Dunedin around 12 years old, mm-hmm. Started going to school, started playing rugby. I was reasonably good at rugby as a child. So started playing rugby again when I was down in Dunedin and was still quite shy. Like I had quite bad acne, was not very confident, had a lot of self-esteem issues that I wasn't completely oblivious to at that stage,
mm-hmm.
And a way that I initially found to ultimately lower these inhibitions was to actually drink alcohol, and all of a sudden, like I developed this nickname, and within maybe the first month of me drinking, they started calling me Mr. Sociable, where the reality was quite a quiet and shy kid. I was good academically,
yeah,
but I was a quiet and shy kid who, again, never really felt like he fitted in and was always really mindful of the impact that I had in any specific kind of environment.
So what age were you when you started drinking?
So I started drinking when I would have been 12.
Oh, yes.
Probably coming into 13, so I was third form. We had a space at one of my really good friend's house that was in my rugby team, that it was okay for us to drink as long as we were drinking there, and like they knew that we were safe.
There mm-hmm.
was, again, I believe that New Zealand's got a very normalised culture amongst alcohol, particularly around young men.
Absolutely.
So I think the idea was the fact that we were safe and we were together and we were at somebody's house.
They want you to drink at home so they can see how you are with the alcohol to get used to it before you go out into the world.
Yes.
That's the idea.
And the reality of it is that we ended up leaving there very quickly after we started to impair our cognitive abilities, and we decided that we'd go for walkabouts and we started going to parties. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how did it progress?
So again, so when I was 12, 13 years old, it was like Friday, Saturday nights, if I was allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
By the age of 14, 15, I started developing this rebellious streak. Some of the memories that I had from childhood started coming back, and
right.
I kind of wanted to get back at my family. So I made some choices. I believed I was a 14-year-old, 15-year-old man who could do what he wanted when he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Very self-focused, very self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm completely unaware of that at the time. And then that's when I decided, at 16, I got a job as a kitchen hand. So I started washing dishes. And working within that industry of hospitality, I saw that drinking was not only acceptable, it was almost expected.
Exactly.
So around 16, 17, I went from drinking on weekends to kind of Thursday, Friday, Saturdays. That slowly progressed to Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturdays. That slowly progressed to every night.
So you became a daily drinker?
Yeah, very much so. Like, I mean, but by the end of my drinking, as it kind of slowly progressed, because I could feel my morals and my values, and like my moral compass just slowly went down. Like, I mean, I would always be able to justify to myself that, well, I'm not drinking before lunchtime, until I started drinking before lunchtime, and then it was, well, I'm not drinking spirits before lunchtime, until I started drinking spirits before lunchtime, and by the end of it, like, I couldn't get out of bed without a bottle of wine. Wow. And that was hidden, usually away from my partner, because I had great shame about that.
Did you ever feel it was a problem? Did you ever try to stop?
I knew it was a problem, but the fear of stopping always outweighed the rational idea of actually doing something about it. I remember the first time I drank before 12 o'clock, and I told myself, I says, this is not okay, and I knew that it wasn't okay, and I knew that that wasn't acceptable, so I had to develop some sort of justifications and rationalizations as to what I was doing, which I found quite easy to do, because the people who I was hanging around with at that stage had what I would have perceived to have worse problems than me. Mm-hmm. So it was easy for me to say, well, at least I'm not a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. So I would always be on a sliding spectrum of what was good and what was bad. And as my moral declination came down, as I needed to, I guess, enhance my ego or to compare it against something to make it okay for me.
Yep. So what made you realize you needed help? What was your rock bottom like? Did you lose jobs, family, trouble with the law?
Yeah, I lost many jobs. So, like, I mean, I became a chef. Like, from the kitchen hand, I then became a chef. Mm-hmm. And I was a chef for 20 years. I kind of traveled around lots of different parts of the world. And again, so when I was around 30 years old, I'd become very skilled within my trade. But, like, I mean, I'd lost, I guess, the respect from a lot of my colleagues due to some of my behaviours. So we'd work big hours, and there was a just, like, I could easily tell myself that it was the whole work hard, play hard mentality.
Exactly.
Is that if I'm going to be doing 14-hour split shifts, then on that split shift from 3 to 5, I'll go down to the bar and drink as much as I can. So that became quite normal. Sometimes I'd go back for service. We'd be doing up to, you know, sometimes we'd do 1,000 people over 2 services in some of the restaurants I was working at, and overseeing a team of maybe 18.
Yeah.
And like, I'd end up pushing plates off the pass that was filled with food, getting waitresses to run it to the wrong place. I was saying inappropriate things and not being able to recall it.
Yeah, so like, very stressful.
Yeah, oh, like, I mean, it was, but again, the fact that I couldn't recall it, it was stressful for everybody else around me.
Yes.
My ultimate justification that I consistently told myself was it was only me that I was hurting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I needed to believe that. Because the reality was, if the impact of the knowledge that everybody who I was around was affected immensely by my drinking, then I would have had to have done something about that. And that scared me. That scared me too much. Because what I found is that for a long time, drinking was actually the solution to a lot of the stuff that really went on that sat underneath my drinking. My drinking was a coping strategy that I developed as a teenager as a way of dealing with my lack of emotional regulation, that I didn't know how to deal with the happiness and the sadness, and I felt quite overwhelmed by it all the time.
Wow. Did you ever get drink driving convictions?
So I had a... It's interesting you asked about driving. I got my learner's driver's license when I was 15, mm-hmm. and I sat on that until I got sober.
Wow.
I'd drive on it, and I'd drive intoxicated on it, which is something that I'm really not proud of. But uncannily, I never got pulled over. And again, my justification was that if I'm going to get pulled over with a learner's license and I'm going to be intoxicated, I'm going to get in trouble anyway. So there was no... I never really took any accountability for my behaviours and just kind of put a lot of it down to luck.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like, through the grace of my higher power, I was never pulled over for any sort of drunk driving convictions.
So how did you feel? What was the decline in your mental and emotional and spiritual well-being at the end of your drinking? What was that like?
So I ended up losing, I think it was 4 jobs in Brisbane in a matter of 2 months.
Mm.
So I decided that I was going to do something about it. And, like, I mean, I had the best intentions that I was... So my plan was, I got a head chef job in Christmas Island. I told the owner of the organisation that I wasn't... that I don't drink, which he was really pleased about.
Yes.
So I packed my bags and I went to Christmas Island to have this whole fresh new start and to make a big change in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I got there the first week and a half. I maintained it. We had a dinner. We had a work dinner. And my boss was there, and he was really pleased with how everything was going and how it was all turning out. And everybody had a drink. So I decided that it was going to be okay for me to have one cider, because I hadn't drunk in two. I think it had been about 2.5 weeks by then.
You deserve it.
I deserved it. Like, I mean, I'm doing so well. What harm can one cider do? And that was my mentality. And, like, I mean, again, I kind of thought I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know what that meant. Mm. Like, I mean, for me, as soon as I had that cider, this insatiable thirst opened up that I'd forgotten that I have, that I've never been able to quench in my entire life. And within a week, I ended up running off Christmas Island with my tail between my legs. And I ended up staying at Mum and Dad's house. I was in a very dark place mentally. I was suicidal. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see a way out, because my plans that kept... That I had the best intentions to make these positive changes, they just... Nothing happened. Nothing happened.
Wow. So how did you find your way to your first AA meeting, and what was that like?
So, like, I mean, when I went back to my family's house, so I went and stayed with Mum and Dad on the Gold Coast as a 32-year-old man, full of shame, full of guilt and remorse, and just, like, shame was the driving factor. Like, I mean, I was just so embarrassed that I'd tried all these things, and I was 32 years old, I'd made all this money, none of it was left. I had $28 on my bank account, and I'm sleeping on my mum and dad's sofa. Mm. I promised them that I wouldn't drink, and as soon as they went to bed, I stole mum's vodka, and I topped it up with water. Not because I wanted to, but I didn't know what else to do. Like, I mean, I was in such a lost space that was my only solution. So, like, the family, so mum and dad got my sister over, and there was a family intervention. So,
okay.
My sister offered me a bed on her sofa at her house, and she said just down the road from her, there was a rehabilitation center. Mm-hmm. I'd ran out of ideas. Like, I mean, it was the last solution. And again, I really didn't want to go. I was really embarrassed about it. But I was really, I could sense that death was really close to me, and I didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live.
Yeah.
So I ended up flying back with my sister. I slept on her sofa. I stole her vodka, promised that I wouldn't. And eventually went into this rehab organization that recommended that I go to AA meetings.
Wow. Mm. So how was your first AA meeting? Do you remember it?
My first AA meeting was, I thought my sister had spoken to a couple of the people who were talking. Because I felt so much like they were talking at me.
Yeah.
And they were telling things that I had done that I had great shame around doing. So I thought that my sister somehow would have told these people or knew them. I thought, very self-centeredly, I thought it was all about me, and I thought that these people were saying stuff that I'd done as a way of impacting my life.
Yes.
What I realized is that it wasn't just me that had done some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Did you feel welcomed?
First meeting, I tried not to be welcomed. I was quite standoffish, really hostile. Mm-hmm. The sign on my head wasn't probably very pleasant to be reading, if it was possible to read that. I remember my third meeting, somebody asked me to share, and I started talking, and I remember I talked about my father's drinking, and I talked about my grandfather's drinking, and then I started trying to talk about mine, and I started crying, and I felt really embarrassed about that, and I got up and I ran out.
Yeah.
And this man ran out after me.
Great.
And, he told me that he could relate, and he was hoping that maybe we could get to know each other. I thought it was very bizarre. Mm. I thought it was very bizarre behavior of a man chasing me out of a room, wanting my phone number. But again, I'd gotten to the point that I'd ran out of options myself, because my choice and my decisions around my life were just, they were no longer serving the needs that I wanted them to be doing.
So how have you managed to stay sober? What's the process of recovery been like for you?
In the early days, like, I mean, I was recommended 90 meetings, 90 days. Did, yep. 90 meetings, 90 days. That man who ran out of that meeting on the third day. So part of the treatment that I came through is in order to go to the next stage of treatment. So it was for 18 weeks, which is quite a long time, residential. Mm-hmm. And in order to progress from phase one to phase two, is we needed to get a sponsor. So that man who chased me out of that meeting that day, I asked him. I had no idea what that meant, but I asked him because I really wanted to, if you got to phase two, you could have weekends out of rehab. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and we developed a relationship. He talked about things like the Big Book, which I thought was the Bible, which I was an atheist, I had no interest in. And he also said that it'd be cool if he could come around when I get out and we'd catch up and maybe go through this book together, which, again, I was open to. I was ready to change, mm-hmm. but I just didn't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. So how do you cope with difficulties?
Currently?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the difficulties that I deal with is, so I've still got a sponsor. Like, I mean, I've got a different sponsor. My sponsor now, he's 30 years sober. A really solid man. He gives me really good perspective on a lot of the single perspective that I have around my own life. He gives me a different view and through a different lens, which really helps me. I still attend AA meetings. I've got a small support network that I feel really close with.
How important has service been as a part of your recovery?
A service keeps me connected. I've got a head that keeps telling me to disengage and not to do it, and I don't need to be here anymore, and I don't need to do this stuff. Service keeps me connected. Again, like I learned at a really early age that in order to enhance self-esteem, we need to do esteemable things.
Mm-hmm.
And I also learned that my journey for recovery was going to be coming from a place of arrogance and narcissism into a place of, I guess, humility. And going from a place of real selfishness and self-centeredness into a place of altruism or selflessness, which, again, I've got a head that will convince me to do otherwise, because it's usually really inconvenient, I guess, to my own selfish needs. But the reality is, as a direct result of doing these specific actions that go against my natural code, I feel better about who I am.
For our listeners, if you've related to anything that you've heard or would like some more information about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can look us up on the web at www.aa.org.nz or call us on 0800 AA Works. There are 66 meetings a week in Canterbury, so it's likely there's one near you. Join us next week to hear from more AA members sharing their experiences. Our show airs every Monday at 6 p.m. on Plains FM and repeats on Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. You can find podcasts of all our past shows on the Plains FM website at plainsfm.org.nz. And I believe you can also download this on iTunes. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. And remember, if you want to drink, that's your business. But if you want to stop, we can help. You don't have to do it alone. We will now close the show with a serenity prayer all together, as we do in every AA meeting.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The difference. You've been listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show on Plains FM 96.9. Just a reminder, this is a two-part show. We're on part one this week, and next week will be part two. If you do miss any shows, you can always download shows from Plains FM 96.9 website.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no younger. Your pain and your hunger, they're driving you home. And freedom, oh, freedom, well, that's
some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone. Don't your feet get cold in the wintertime? The sky won't snow and the sun won't shine. It's hard to tell the night time from the day.